Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Wittstock, and in today's conversation, I speak to Professor Margaret O'Mara. Margaret is the Howard and Francis Keller Endowed Professor of History at the University of Washington. She's also the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America, which was published in 2019, and I think is an absolutely amazing study of what has made Silicon Valley and the American tech industry, literally what has made it, what makes it unique, and what makes it as successful as it has been. And why it continues to be place an organization, an ecosystem of technological creation that policymakers around the world are seeking to emulate. I really strongly recommend anyone and everyone listening to this podcast to immediately read her book. It's a really comprehensive and engaging account of the origins and development of the U.S. tech industry, but also gives really great historical context to all of the current policy debates around big tech. It will also dispel many of the myths surrounding it as well. And it also incredibly helpful in explaining what this industry really is, how it functions, who the important players are, and how they're connected. I'd say this book is really one of the first ones that I recommend to anyone who wants to be better informed about an industry that is continuing to shape the present and future of not just America, but really around the world. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Professor Margaret O'Mara.
Hello, Margaret O'Mara.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much. This is actually the first podcast of this kind that we're recording in person, so it's very cool to talk to you. So, Margaret, you're the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Let's maybe start with what exactly is Silicon Valley? What industry? Are we talking about the place? Or are we talking about an industry? Is it a group of companies? What is Silicon Valley?
Well, right now, talking in 2022, Silicon Valley is a place in California. It's a shorthand for a whole industry, I would say broadly computer hardware and software, internet industries, but that's pretty wide. Mm-hmm. It's often applied to a mentality or a type of business culture. It's a global network, a supply chain that stretches across continents and across oceans, involves many different regions, not just the one in California. But what is remarkable about the place in California, this 10-mile by 2-mile strip of California suburbia, that it remains the command and control center in terms of it's the largest cluster of venture capital funding for high tech. It's where three of the five biggest companies are. The other two are up the coast here in Seattle. So in a way, Seattle is a northern adjunct of Silicon Valley. Not everyone in Seattle likes my interpretation of that, but I think that part of explaining why Seattle has the tech economy it does is because of that proximity. It's a 2-hour plane flight and a lot of connections of people and capital and ideas flow between the two places. So Silicon Valley is, yes, it's a place, an idea, an industry. It's a lot of things at once, which is one reason why it looms so large in the public imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't really go a day probably without reading something about Silicon Valley. Yeah. One question that I guess immediately comes to mind is, when did this, you call it software and hardware, computer services, I guess, manufacturing and computer services. When does this industry get started and why does it start where it does?
In the beginning, the American computer industry, the digital computer industry was all on the East Coast, which is kind of remarkable. And it migrates west. The beginning of the high-tech story of Silicon Valley, or it begins with small electronics and radar and microwave communication, so communication devices. And at the beginnings of that, before the Second World War, there's startups and old fruit drying sheds and garages. Most famously, Hewlett Packard, now HP, was founded in 1939 by a couple of Stanford alumni. Stanford is founded in 1890, establishes itself as a engineering-focused school from the get-go. By the time you get to the middle part of the 20th century, it's got a good reputation. It's not the Harvard of the West, but it is, you know, it's pretty strong in some areas, but it's still a little bit off the side. The thing that really, the flywheel that gets everything going is the Second World War, and then after that, the military spending of the Cold War. And that remaps America's economic geography. It contributes to millions of people migrating to California in the post-war period. And it brings vastly enlarges funding for electronics, particularly advanced small electronics, transistorized electronics, that the Valley very rapidly establishes a specialty in, particularly silicon semiconductors, hence the name Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, the Silicon Valley story is typically, I think, maybe the common imagination understood as some sort of entrepreneurial dream or accomplishment. Mm-hmm. But your book makes very clear that government and especially, as you say, military funding was there from the start and really what, at the very least, the spark that lit the fire. But still, I'm just curious about what it is about the locations that were chosen. Because as you were saying earlier in a private conversation between you and me, all the capital at that time was on the East Coast. The big companies, manufacturing sites were much further in the East than really this very western point of California. What was the rationale in funneling so much of that funding in that area?
Well, part of it had to do with the Pacific Theater of the Second World War and the established capacity even before the Second World War, up and down the Pacific Coast, ports that were export oriented, that there was a significant military presence up and down all the way from Seattle to San Diego from the First World War forward, but that vastly enlarges during the Second World War. And you have industries like aerospace up in Seattle, down in LA, and you have emerging competencies in radio communication in the Bay Area. Again, very small and niche. It's not a big industry by any means. But you have shipbuilding up and down. And so as the Cold War hardens in the late 50s, and then particularly after the Korean War era of the early 50s, when the U.S. establishes on an ongoing basis, significant spending on a peacetime military. It's the Cold War, but it's not a hot war. That sends this wave of money westward. So that's a factor. But the other factor is also it's politics, right? The ability of home state senators to bring home the bacon, so to speak. That is a factor in the industrialization of the Sun Belt in the West and the Pacific West. We see this in Washington State quite vividly with Warren Magnuson and Scoop Jackson, bringing money to Boeing. But in the Bay Area, you have local actors, and particularly in the South Bay, I think two really critical actors. One is Stanford University and the administrators of Stanford at that moment, including notably Fred Terman, who was a kid who was son of a Stanford faculty member, grows up in Palo Alto. Studies engineering at MIT. His graduate mentor there is Vannevar Bush, who ends up running the Office of Science and Research Development during the Second World War. He's Roosevelt's General of Physics, as he's called, and is the guy with the idea that becomes the National Science Foundation. He is the one pushing Washington to create an ongoing investment in not just military technologies, but the other thing that's happening simultaneously, connected to the Cold War, to be clear, is vast amounts of federal spending on science and technology, academic science and technology, which was not something that had happened prior.
Right.
That was new. So Terman knows, kind of is out at Stanford, but he realizes it has a real window into what's happening. During the Second World War, he's back in Cambridge working for Bush or working at MIT on war-related work, as so many engineers were and scientists were during the war. He comes back to Stanford and he says, you know, this is our way up from kind of mid-level status. Mm-hmm. we have a chance. And the way to do that is to remake the university and its curriculum to build up physics, to build up our capacity, our existing capacity in electronics and these very specialized things that the military is going to need. So Stanford becomes this perfect Cold War university. Mm-hmm. And it also becomes a perfect training ground for industry. And Terman himself plays a very personal role in bringing former students like Hewlett and Packard, encouraging them to locate in Palo Alto, for encouraging the co-inventor of the transistor, William Shockley, as he's leaving Bell Labs for Shockley's actually was also from Palo Alto, to persuading him to come home and mm-hmm. start his silicon semiconductor startup, the first of its kind, in Palo Alto, in the Valley. And that is the beginning. That is the, you know, Shockley hires these eight young engineers from to work for him. He quickly proves to be the worst boss ever among his many faults. And those eight engineers leave, start their own company, get venture backing, and that's Fairchild Semiconductor, which is the first venture-backed startup. So the Stanford factor is a huge, huge factor. So it's this great story of top-down and bottom-up, right? It's not just the Cold War happened and all this money washed over things. It's you had actors there. The other thing, and Terman played a role in this, but the second thing that sets the Valley apart, is that Lockheed, which is based in L.A., locates its Missiles and Space Division in Sunnyvale, which is about 10 miles down the road from Stanford. That's in 1954-55. They do that in part because federal contracts were, defense contracts were encouraging big contractors to disperse their operations so that when the nuclear attack happened, everything wouldn't get wiped out at once. So that was part of it. But also, the Lockheed executives knew that Stanford was there and that you had Fred Terman, who was by that point dean of engineering, about to be provost, saying, we will provide trained engineers. We will design our program so our people are learning exactly what you need to do to build these rockets and missiles. Mm-hmm. And so Lockheed moves to the Valley, is its largest employer through the late 80s. This is kind of the biggest secret of Silicon Valley, that the kind of the part that people don't know about, in part because almost everything they did was top secret. So nobody could talk about what they were doing. Right. And they couldn't go home for dinner and tell their families, like, guess what I did today? Much less appear on the cover of Fortune magazine as the next great scientific genius. So this just, but it has an incredibly generative effect. It draws thousands of engineers to the Valley. It's this huge employer. Those engineers, some of them leave to start their own companies that are significant. For example, there was a really early stage, very important and influential timesharing company called Timeshare that's founded in the 60s. Timesharing is kind of like the internet before the internet, getting computers to talk to one another. And also the kids of these Lockheed engineers, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, is a kid of a Lockheed engineer. So this just, that major employer is, you know, is one of a number. But a really interesting thing about the Valley in its earliest years, this wasn't a startup capital. It quickly becomes that. But it is the first, the big industrial presence begins with companies like Lockheed or IBM or RCA or Honeywell or Sylvania that are located elsewhere, most on the East Coast, that open research labs for specialized small electronics in the vicinity. Stanford builds a research park for those to lure those people westward. So it's a much more, I think, interesting story of a lot of different actors. The other thing that is really important, because you, as you observed, Silicon Valley has this free enterprise, you know, it's supposed to be the playground of free enterprise, like so far removed from government. And yet it has these government roots. So what explains that? Like why the collective amnesia or why this separation? And the way that we answer that is we look into the political economy of the Cold War, military industrial complex itself, which was very much a product of the politics of the early 50s, right? So what's going on then? Well, it's McCarthyism. It's President Eisenhower, who's kind of a not a big government guy. Like he's a, you know, prefers government to stay in its lane or to have let private industry have as much flexibility as it can. But he also recognizes there is a grave geopolitical threat. He's a military guy. He understands that this is necessary. But look at the structure of the way in which federal contracting worked at that time. And quite frankly, the way it's always worked, which is money from the federal government not going to build enormous research labs, although it does some of that. But it also goes to universities, public and private. It goes to private industries and contractors like Lockheed, like Fairchild Semiconductor, these large and small companies. So it's privatized. It's, you create this parastatal network of private and academic actors that are doing the government's work and being funded by the government. But they also, relatively speaking, and I say relatively because there was plenty of complaints by these people about the government procurement system and all the things the government made them do. But it was kind of a, you know, they threw a lot of money in Silicon Valley's direction and kind of got out of the way, mostly.
Right, yeah.
There was not a lot of looking over your shoulder and intense oversight, in part because everything was so new. The Cold War was, the Cold War threat was immense. There was an incredible amount of political pressure and pressure from both the White House and the Pentagon to move fast. There was an urgency to all of it. This extended not just through the Pentagon's work, but also through NASA. I mean, NASA, the space program, the American space program is a Cold War project. And the technologies that send astronauts to the moon are the same that power missiles. It's all the same stuff. So those, that imperative creates this space for new entrants like Silicon Semiconductor companies to get contracts. And creates enough room for this very competitive market-oriented industry to grow.
So I guess I have two questions. I'm not sure which one to go with first, but maybe the first question being, in the 50s, it's still accurate to say that most of the companies that would be associated with Silicon Valley are, at the end of the day, military contractors.
Sure. I mean, overwhelming. Yes. And even though a company like Hewlett-Packard, for example, would, you know, emphasize, well, look at this contract we have with Walt Disney to make the oscillators for Fantasia. Like, that was one of their early contracts. Yes, it is the, it is, there is a commercial, but there's not much because there's not much. These are the thing that Silicon Valley is making. First of all, there are no consumer products involved here. None. In fact, the first consumer products that the Valley creates don't come until the late 70s with the personal computer and video games. Before that, everything is selling to the enterprise. And at the beginning, selling to the government.
Interesting. So what is the significance of the semiconductor then in moving away from just being military contractors at the end of the day and getting into consumer markets?
Well, this is again a kind of great story of the political economy of the of this moment. So, and Fairchild Semiconductor is a great place to look. So Fairchild Semiconductor is incorporated, loosely incorporated by these eight, the traitorous eight, as they're known, in September 1957. October 1957 is Sputnik. So the Soviets beat the U.S. into orbit. Dwight Eisenhower, all of his military aides are just like, it's you know, if Eisenhower had hair, it would be on fire. And that is also accompanied with a report that lands on Eisenhower's desk the next month, warning of a missile gap with the Soviet Union. The Soviets are vastly outpacing the U.S. So this creates incredible urgency around developing advanced electronics and that can and rocketry. And so, and that is, of course, exactly what a silicon semiconductor is. So Fairchild has the great good fortune. It doesn't incorporate as we're going to go after defense money, although that kind of was the lifeblood at that time. So it wasn't, but they weren't kind of seeing, I don't think any company sort of, well, some do, but generally didn't incorporate saying we're going to be a defense contractor. It's just kind of, that's what the market was. But their first few years, the majority of their book of business is from the government. And then in 1961, 62, the integrated circuit, which is putting more circuits on a chip, like even more powerful, really a microchip. That's right. Essentially kind of is developed by Robert Noyce, who's one of the co-founders of Fairchild and later is a co-founder of Intel. And it's also developed sort of simultaneously by other people elsewhere. It's sort of a funny thing about technological development, right? They have these parallel things. So the integrated circuits that Fairchild is selling, they're incredibly expensive. There is zero commercial market for these expensive things because they're way more firepower than you need for most commercial applications at the time.
So like a calculator or whatever. Yeah.
You don't need a miniature. People are buying mainframes, these giant things from IBM. IBM's cornered the market on that. It's the dominant player in the computer market. You know, when people think about big tech in the 60s or the 70s, it's IBM. It's not any of these companies are just totally off the, no one's paying attention. The Wall Street Journal's not writing about them, nothing. But the one customer that needs what Fairchild is selling is the Apollo, is NASA. And right at the same time this new powerful technology is being developed, John Kennedy is saying, we shall go to the moon by the end of the decade, further amping up the need and the opportunity to just spend a lot of money and buy these things. So it's not just Fairchild, it's these other semiconductor companies that are growing up around the same time in this same little Galapagos of very distinctive business culture that's emerging in the Valley, far apart from most everything else. And that is the only place that is building these very special things that NASA needs. And so those space age contracts really that sends this into overdrive. But how do you get a commercial market out of that? When you have a big, deep-pocketed customer who's going to buy your expensive things, well, you can scale up production. You can drive down costs. This is also another Fairchild founder and Intel co-founders, Gordon Moore, who's Moore's Law, which really he posited partially as a bit of a marketing ploy for Fairchild to be like, we're going to be so fast, we can go this. Definitely worked out. But essentially that these devices are going to become more powerful and more cheaper. And it's true. It's extraordinary. So this is being enabled. Again, this is the federal government here is a catalyst. It's the company that's developing the technology, that's figuring out go-to-market strategies, it's figuring out, how to put efficiencies into the production process that are going to drive down costs, all those things. But effectively, because you have some place to sell these things, these companies are allowed to get off the ground and to scale. And you emerge by the end of the 60s with cheaper commercially available microchips that now are, this can go in a car. This can go in a piece of industrial machinery. This can go in all these things. And then by the time you get to the 1970s and Intel becoming a very successful company in the early 70s, it is a very commercial facing, almost entirely commercial book of business. It's not a defense contractor. And defense spending's gone down by that time.
Right.
So, like it's really that whole ecosystem has changed dramatically because of the Vietnam War.
And how long does it take then before American companies get wary about the very quick catch up of Japan in those same industries?
In a matter of a few years, very quickly. So there's a really interesting sort of market story here. So the 1970s, right? Not a great year for the U.S. economy, or a great decade for the U.S. economy. Stagflation, oil crisis. The stock market is moribund. The bond market is bad. All the markets are terrible. Venture capitalists cannot raise money. And particularly for kind of what was then called risk capital. This is very high tech stuff that may or may not work. So if you're being very conservative in your investments, you're not going to do this. And so this is really challenging the pretty new model of venture-backed startups where you're getting other people's money to invest in these new ventures and you're paying people in stock options. You're doing things that the whole model becomes more challenged. So what happens is that in some cases Silicon Valley companies will license their technology to Japan. And in other cases, get Japanese investment or, you know, in a way, you know, more than one entrepreneur really regretted later they kind of gave away their most precious goodies to Japan. And meanwhile, what's going on in Japan, it's, you know, capitalist developmentalism. It's MITI, the all incredibly powerful agency that is subsidizing advanced technological development, is advancing the state of the art in chip manufacturing, taking ideas and innovations that are coming out of the United States and able to execute on them in the way that the U.S. is not. There's not that public financing that's coming in. Mm-hmm. And so by the time you get to the end of the 70s, Japanese chips Japan is able to flood the market with chips that are priced lower because they're subsidized. And the quality is going up. So for a long time, the American chip makers, Californians in particular, had the edge on, well, we make the really, like, good stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, when you really need good stuff, you get it from us. And Japan was beating them on price and matching them on quality and sometimes exceeding them in terms of the bringing advanced chips to market. So interestingly, it's the California chip makers that really get hammered on this. The Texas guys are not necessarily their allies in this. First of all, the chief executive of Texas Instruments calls them California crybabies. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just whining about, you know, how Japan's being mean to them and asking, by this point, going to the Reagan administration and asking for some trade protectionism and some support.
Tax cuts.
And to help them. Mm-hmm. And the nature of what they had been building and selling that really was, it was pretty dark for a few years. And that's, this was just the chip makers, mind you. The personal computer industry, which by that point is growing, they liked having access to cheap chips. Yeah. Like, that's not a problem for them. So there's a really interesting, Silicon Valley as a block has never been monolithic.
Yeah, yeah.
There are different interests here. And absolutely, that was very clear in this late 70s, early 80s moment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really fascinating. And then you mentioned, so at the same time, the personal computer industry is sort of emergent, which then, how quickly does that then create a industry or market, at least for software as well? Because that is sort of integrally tied to the personal computer.
It is. It is. Pretty quickly, although that was not the intent of the Silicon Valley creators. One of the really distinctive things about, right now we associate Silicon Valley with software and internet companies, right? Back then it was all hardware. Software was not a standalone industry, really. I mean, yes, there were some software companies, but they were building for mainframes and they were, it was not the industry that it later becomes at all. The industry is really effectively created by Microsoft because Microsoft becomes the first company that is writing software, operating systems, and apps for the personal computer.
Right.
And they're doing that in a way that was not, again, not the plan. So when the first hobbyists start playing around with taking these powerful, at this point, by the early 70s, Intel has released what it calls the computer and a chip. The microprocessor and other companies follow suit. It essentially is a computer. You can do multiple functions on this microchip. So once you've miniaturized that far, all you do is build a wooden box around it and hook it up to a TV and put a typewriter, get a keyboard, and you've got a desktop computer. I mean, it's not what you and I would be think, but it got you there. But the people who are doing this are building their own machines, and they're also programmers. They're like, if you're serious about this, you write your own stuff. You write your own operating system and you write your own programs. And then if you've written that, you share freely. It's open source.
Yes.
You just swap the code. You have a zine, you have a publication, a magazine that you put off, you mimeograph every week and you have the code written out there and you share it. And meanwhile, Bill Gates, who notably is not in the Valley, he's dropping out of Harvard. He's going with his Seattle childhood friend, moving to Albuquerque to be sort of co-located with the first company that is producing these, what were then called microcomputers, that were already built together instead of having to build your own.
Right. Yeah.
And that's Microsoft Basic becomes packaged with that as here's the operating system. Mm-hmm. Now you don't have to do that either. And for the purists of the, you know, the hobbyist clubs, which were all over, but particularly the homebrew club is the one in the valley, we're like, that is not the way it's done. And so they keep on, they're like, basic's pretty good. We're just going to share it with each other.
Right.
And so Gates, at age 20, writes a letter to the hobbyist, to the homebrew hobbyist, saying, what you were doing is theft. Mm-hmm. We are trying to build a business here. This is not okay. It's a fabulous letter. Lakeside School taught this young man how to write correspondence very well. or maybe the elder Gateses. But it really was this was throwing down the gauntlet in a war that continues to this day, which is proprietary versus open source.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And different philosophies about what these technologies are for, what can be monetized.
Mm-hmm.
And even though in the early years of the PC industry, Microsoft, as it grows and becomes such a dominant force, thanks in good part because IBM decides to build a PC and Microsoft gets the deal to write the operating system for it. But also Microsoft did the OS and apps for Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Like up until the mid 80s, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were business partners. Mm-hmm. And then Windows came along and it all fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a real, there are these close connections, in part because the industry, the personal computer industry, at the beginning was quite small. You had to work together.
People knew each other.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So the conflict between open source and proprietary software, and crucially here also, I think you mentioned this in the book as well, are these Supreme Court cases on what is legitimate material to be patented.
Mm-hmm.
1982 declaring that software can be patented as well, which then you can think about this two ways, right? If you're the open source crowd, you say, well, this seems like you're appropriating something that was slowly emergent, right? Like the knowledge around how to code, what standards to use and things like that. And us, Microsoft comes along and in effect appropriates a lot of that knowledge in certain ways, right? And then finds a way to commercialize and make a lot of money off it. The other side of the coin, right? It's that there is something to it. The fact that you have a standardized system to use that runs everywhere, that, it's probably less buggy, I would assume.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, it's being offered to people at pretty low cost. So could say worked out for everyone. Not sure everyone would agree,
but it's a really interesting moment in terms of both in terms of court cases and regulatory decisions and decisions happening, across all three branches of the federal government in particular, but also at the state level, which is kind of coming to terms with this new economy and what its products are and adjusting. Look, we have a regulatory system. The way in which business and intellectual property is understood and recognized by the government is conditioned to the Industrial Revolution, right? It's conditioned to the thing that the product in question being a thing, something you would hold or touch. And intellectual property, kind of the notion, different from copyright, different from creative production, but something that this is something that I sell and this is something I can replicate, is one way in which all of these, all of this is kind of this evolving, this really interesting evolving conversation, and biotech is playing in here too, right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
And that, patenting a life form,
like
the notion that can be patented and that you can maybe manipulate a life form for that matter. So all these things are kind of stewing around at the same moment. And, proprietary, the tension of, what's better. Now it's echoing through in this question of, Apple, can an Apple iPhone be unlocked?
Yeah.
Right. The right to repair, like all these things are still echoing through. Is it better to have a totally hermetically sealed system? What advantages does that give? Or do you have something that's more open and iterative? And there's a politics behind it. It's the cathedral and the bazaar. It's this very, and where it boils, where we see this manifesting too, is by the 1990s as Microsoft is referred to by people down in the valley as the Death Star or the frat house from another planet. It's this big thing up here in Seattle that is adversarial. It has eaten all everything else, all these other smaller companies that were doing, you know, word processing, you know, oh, here comes Microsoft Word, you know, it just gobbles up like Pac-Man, all of these other ideas. And it is, you know, so when you go down to this or walk in the Stanford Computer Science Building in circa 1996, you're going to find a lot of professors and graduate students who are deeply, deeply committed to, you know, all Unix all the time or open source, like really philosophically. And very interested in transparency and free flows of information. And it's not coincidental that in that building, walking in 1996, are Larry Page and Sergey Brin, his first-year grad students. And the search engine that they create that becomes the Google search engine and the subsequent sort of the larger philosophy of Google is so much in kind of reaction to the Death Star. The great irony of all this is Bill Gates, who did not attend Stanford, had by that point put his name on the building by a generous donation that had helped its construction. So all this is happening in the Bill Gates Computer Science Building at Stanford.
That is pretty funny, yeah. So in the 90s, or how do we get to the commercialization of, or even the creation of the internet? If you could just explain how that transition works from the idea of connecting personal computers. You had mentioned time sharing before.
Well, it's the question of connecting or getting computers to talk to one another or to collectively work as a unit has been a live one since the beginning of the digital age, and is very closely coupled with sort of the broader question of computer intelligence and you know, human machine symbiosis. Some of the same people are pursuing these questions. And the internet, you know, in a way that the arc of the internet is similar to what we've talked about in terms of the military origins and the commercial, but the way that the way that it's constructed. So the internet begins as a Pentagon project, project of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency, which itself came into being right after Sputnik as part of that panic when gotta do something. So we're going to have an advanced research agency. And the within that agency, there was a an engineer with connections both to the communities and at in and around Stanford and MIT, and who'd been very much part of these conversations about how we get computers to communicate and how we have these big federally funded academic computer centers at these various research universities, but they can't really talk to one another. And what if they could? Then we could collaborate. Then we could, the whole could be greater than the sum of its parts, so to speak. And so within DARPA, the person in question, Bob Taylor, goes to his military superiors and says, can I have $1 million thereabouts? And, you know, that's real money, and it was real money in the early 60s. But in the Pentagon budget, then and now, it's like, okay, we can do that. So he gets money for this pretty speculative project, and it is not one that is designed by the military, even though it makes sense in terms of defense planners had already taught the SAGE system, which is this anti-missile defense system, was already in operation, which was a kind of predecessor to the internet, so to speak. But this was very much designed, what was then the ARPANET was designed for research, for academic researchers. And so it was designed by the researchers themselves. It was designed to be non-hierarchical. This was something that made sense for the Pentagon too, because if you knocked out one node, you wouldn't knock out the whole network. So there's sort of a useful, again, you can't separate these technological, these projects from their defense uses. And, you know, there's has to be a defense rationale somewhere. But it really was chiefly designed to let these federally funded academic computer centers talk, supercomputing projects talk to one another. And so it begins with just a handful and then grows pretty rapidly over the course of the 1970s and becomes this this academic network and network used by government contractors and remains that until the early 90s, that you have to be getting money from the Fed somewhere to be on the internet. And by the end of the 80s, they're allowing corporate entities to have websites. But this is before, but they weren't websites then. They were sites on the internet, because the World Wide Web itself as a concept is this sort of navigational overlay of the backbone of the internet, only is conceived of by Tim Berners-Lee in 89, 90, 91. So there's, but no commercial activity can happen. That's the one firewall. Like, know that this is the rule. In the 80s, the management of the internet moves from Defense Department to the National Science Foundation. It's the NSFNet for a while. But still, no buying or selling, no greedy commerce anywhere. But at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, two things happen. And actually, Al Gore is involved in both of them. He did not invent the internet. But he was pretty, you know, he was not, he played a role, which is Gore co-sponsors legislation to beef up funding for supercomputing and for a more powerful network to run between those centers. This is also in response to Japan, which has these big supercomputing projects. And so this is very much in that, you know, keyed in that economic concern about economic competition. And so that creates enough capacity for the internet to grow and to carry more traffic. And actually, and simultaneously, Gore and others are being with, you know, the lobbying and advocacy of Silicon Valley players, considering legislation that will open up the internet to commercialization. And so by the time you get to 1991, and certainly by the time Bill Clinton is in office with his vice president, Al Gore, the internet has commercialized. And the World Wide Web has been established as a navigational tool. The thing that really sets this off for the rest of us who are not still part of this relatively small community of people on the internet is the development of the first browser, Mosaic, comes out of one of those supercomputing centers at the University of Illinois. It's commercialized by one of its creators, Marc Andreessen, as Netscape. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the first big .com boom success story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I encourage everyone to read the book. So I think the story of how this commercialization of the internet happens in the 90s under Clinton especially is fascinating, really instructive to, and again, you mentioned this before, that really a lot of these same conversations that people are still having, a lot of these conflict lines are drawn then or probably even before, right? Mm-hmm. But they're sort of inherent to the technology almost, or to certain trade-offs and decisions that are being made at the time.
Yeah.
You mentioned previously that obviously Silicon Valley is not a monolith. There are different sub-industries within that broad sort of bucket of industries, right? And now, as we were saying, now we have these additional entities which are effectively only internet companies, right?
Yeah.
So something like Facebook is not really engaged in hardware whatsoever, right? And I suppose software sort of, but it's almost a separate entity, I'd say. Mm. The interesting thing is that the tech industry as such was probably unanimously anti-Trump. That being said, parts of it did see some use or some opportunistic opportunity maybe in Trump's very strong anti-China stance, which I think mirrors the whole Japan story that you were saying earlier, where now everyone is concerned about Chinese companies, Chinese increasing capacities in some of these areas. A lot of the same concerns about we're licensing a lot of technology to Chinese companies. Now we're complaining about technological theft and technology transfer to China. The reason why I'm bringing this up is, like, to what extent can we say that this industry is really independent of Washington to any significant extent? Hmm. You know, is this industry somewhat beholden to Washington? Is Washington beholden to this industry where, you know, again and again, it seems like when things go wrong or when things get rough, parts of this industry keep reaching out for certain policy help and tend to get it too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and in that way, they're like every other part of American business.
Of course,
right?
Of course, yeah.
So I think there's, if we're looking right now, there's a mutual interdependence and it's kind of impossible for the two to untangle from one another. And those ties have always been there. They just haven't been as obvious as they are now. And but it's complicated,
yeah.
Right? So China is a great example of the complexity. It goes back in some ways, echoes the 1980s, and that Silicon Valley is not a monolith, or the technology industry's interests are not necessarily all the same. If you're a hardware manufacturer who has a direct competitor from China, or someone who's like, you know, duplicating your, you know, or a software, proprietary software manufacturer who has sort of a IP violations from Chinese companies, then you want to create a boundary. But the problem is that nearly every part of the technology industry, whether it be hardware, software, or internet, is totally intertwined with China in terms of supply chain. So where are all our Apple devices manufactured? China. Subcontractors in China. You know, Foxconn, Apple subcontractor, has like a million workers who are making these things. So it's extremely difficult. You know, and that low-cost labor is built into the business model, into the price point. If you go into, say, the actual architecture of internet routers, so Huawei, for example, is, you know, the connections, it is not so easy. It isn't like you have a device and you cut the cord and bygone. The way in which the evolution of the software and the hardware, the way that it's, that the machine itself is working, has so many multinational interconnections that it very is very, very hard to unwind a system that now is, again, kind of born globally and born of an era when China was providing certain critical inputs. Initially, low-cost labor, manufacturing. Increasingly, over the last decade and a half, in a most pronounced way, kind of moving up the value chain into not just industrial design, but also software design, and things that are pretty integral and very high level. The major Silicon Valley players, the major tech players have long had a presence in China in terms of research offices and engineering offices. And you also have markets, right? So, you know, from Uber to Facebook to, I mean, this has been the woe of the big consumer-facing platforms, is that they have had such a hard time getting into China. I mean, they may be the ones with a sort of strong interest in limiting the power of these Chinese rivals.
Right.
They use that as a case for why Washington should not break them up. It was one place where Trump and the tech giants were very much aligned, where Trump and Mark Zuckerberg really could agree strongly, was that keeping American companies big would fend off China. I wrote a piece in a new collection about the Trump presidency, kind of historians' first take on Trump, and I wrote a chapter about the tech industry. And in the course of putting that book together, the former president requested, and we gave a Zoom. We had a Zoom chat with him.
Oh my God!
And this book was released released about 2 weeks ago. And actually, the video of our Zoom recording is available. The Atlantic published a piece by our editor that embeds that, and also
talks about
our meeting. And that video is actually going to be archived at Princeton. Princeton's archives are keeping it for future research. But it was very interesting. I had a brief moment of where I had an interchange with him about this. And it was so clear to me. It was so interesting because, as you observed, Silicon Valley was not big on Trump 2016,
right,
with the exception of Peter Thiel, who's now becoming a Republican kingmaker of sorts, I suppose. We'll see if any people he's supporting get elected. But at the same time, they have shared interests in terms of they're big companies. They want lower corporate tax rates.
Of course.
Trump delivered that. More aggressive stance on China could be problematic, but for some parts of the Valley was beneficial. And Trump, interestingly, you know, he feels like, I'm a billionaire just like you. He sees this.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up from very clearly from the way that he was talking about them. You know, well, they don't like me, but I like them. You know, he sees himself as one of them. Like, he sees himself as like, I get you. I'm a businessman. I'm a really rich guy. We share the same basic outlook on things, which I found so interesting, considering how all of the other, storm and fury, sound and fury that has accompanied Trump's relationship with Silicon Valley. But of course, he is the ultimate social media president. I mean, Barack Obama was hailed in 2008 for using Facebook, and he's the social media president, and he's so, you know, cool, and this is great, and he's online, and he's doing Reddit AMAs, and you know what? Trump knew how to, I mean, that was the internet of 2008.
Right.
Facebook of 2008, which was a little, what should we say, kinder, gentler, and a lot less crowded. And when Trump shows up in 2016, he is already a Twitter power user, and he knows it's an attention economy, and the loudest voice in the room, you need to be loud to get people's attention. It's information overload. There's too much. And that, just as the platforms understood, the most engaging posts are the ones that are the most enraging.
Right.
That's what gets people on and gets people commenting, gets people sticking around. And he knew how to use it so, so effectively.
Absolutely. Margaret O'Mara, thank you so much for being part of the forum.
Yeah, it was a delight to be here. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wittstock. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review, as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.